Over the next 2 years, Governor Scott Walker's budget would cut state aid to counties, school districts, all local governments. That's over 2 years by $1.2 billion. Now, the figures show that most of that, about between $800 and $900 million would be cut to state school aids, but still a large chunk of that would be cuts to local governments. So we've asked three experts in local governments to help discuss the governor's budget repair bill, the budget bill in terms of local governments. I want to thank, to my left, Dan Thompson, Executive Director, League of Wisconsin Municipalities. Larry Arf, City Manager from Beloit, thanks for coming up.
It's my pleasure.
You have a unique story to tell. And Mark O'Connell, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Counties Association. Wow. Budget repair bill rewrites the collective bargaining arrangements. Budget bill cuts state aid. The bottom line effect of both changes, can I ask everybody the 10,000 foot, how do you feel about it? Are we on the eve of a new era of state-local relations, Dan?
Well, I think we are. I mean, the economy of the state is changing and governmental services will have to change in response. We are here today talking, though, about a significant percentage cut in shared revenue. 8 years ago today, or 8 years ago at this time, then Governor McCallum proposed the entire elimination of shared revenue, as you well recall.
Oh, yes.
So compared to Governor
McCallum's
idea, this is very modest, although it's also true that Governor McCallum had trouble running on that campaign platform. It proved not to be very popular with the voters. So have big proposals been made in the past? Yes. Are they typically politically destabilizing? Absolutely. And this one is too. It's a big proposal. We'll have to see how the voters ultimately react to it.
I think Governor Scott McCallum, big spenders. Isn't that what he said, gentlemen?
He did.
Larry, new era?
Certainly in the collective bargaining realm, the proposals are dramatic and they're unprecedented. It's been decades that we've had collective bargaining in the state, and I think one of the concerns that a lot of us have with that, you know, being municipal officials, is what the real operational impact will be. Clearly, there will be some savings as employees begin to pay their portion of the pension contributions. But beyond that, operationally and looking at changes in the future, we still have police and fire unions in our municipalities. We're still going to be negotiating with them every year or two. And we certainly have to be concerned about internal equity. We need to be concerned about morale and esprit de corps among our varied workforces, which collaborate and work together on any number of projects and service delivery initiatives. So I think going forward, we're wondering what impact this is really going to have and whether or not the changes are going to be worth all the bloodshed that's going on across the street.
All the bloodshed. What a phrase. Now, Mark, you've been watching this for years. You've been working on the Wisconsin Way, which offered some different options. Mm-hmm. Your reaction to what the governor has recommended, both in the budget repair and the budget bill, sir?
I think we are on the eve of a very fundamental change in the way we enact public policy and in the way that public policy will affect our citizens. When we look at a budget bill and a budget repair bill with the binding arbitration, collective bargaining changes, the splitting off of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the centralization of income maintenance, the preclusion of certain of employers from paying a certain amount of insurance premium, from requiring certain pension contributions from a portion of our employees, society is going to look very different. And when we've done all of this, we've done it essentially balancing our state budget, but looking at only half of the equation. The spending side, without the revenue side. And it's we have a large problem in this state, and we've decided to only look at spending, which has meant that there's been significant pain revealed in the budget. We all expected it, but it is significant. And I think that's going to have major changes in the coming years.
Let me ask another 10,000 foot question. Do you think the people of this state favor Governor Walker's changes, both in collective bargaining and putting our fiscal house in order by cutting state aid to your local governments? Mark, you want to go first?
I think it's very split.
Very split.
I mean, the polls will, depends upon what question you ask. I mean, do you support people losing rights? Well, you might get more than half the state saying, well, I don't think that's such a good idea. But should public employees have less compensation or a less attractive benefit package? Well, I think you get more than half the citizens. I think here in Madison and Dane County, I'm not sure we have the feel for the state that we have here in Dane County. So I think it's very mixed at this point.
City Beloit residents, Larry?
Well, I think clearly the governor was just elected in November. Although he did not specifically address collective bargaining, he did campaign that he was going to balance the state's budget, eliminate the structural deficit completely on the expenditure side without any revenue enhancements or tax increases of any sort. So that set the stage for deep budget cuts across state services, and clearly the public voted for that just a few months ago. On the collective bargaining side, the polls around the state do not tend to be supportive of taking that radical of an action to literally eliminate collective bargaining rights for most public sector workers. I don't think, from what I've been reading, that the governor has brought a base of support on that issue as he might have had he stuck to simply balancing the budget and dealing with expenditure cuts.
Dan, was the governor riding a wave of public opinion, sir?
Your question is, was the governor riding a wave of public opinion?
Yes.
All folks who get elected to public office ride waves of public opinion,
or they
don't get elected. Now, your question, your initial question was, how will the voters feel about some of the provisions in this budget? And Mark O'Connell was exactly right in his answer that depends on how you ask the question. Mm-hmm. If you ask people, is it okay that shared revenues are cut? An awful lot of people's eyes are going to glaze over. They're not going to know what you're talking about. If you ask the question, should we downsize the police department, the fire department, the library, the parks, those are all very popular services that we provide. At the local level, we don't provide very many unpopular services. If they were unpopular, we wouldn't do it.
That's correct.
So we're providing popular services. If you ask people if they like the services, the answer you'll get is yes. If you ask people how do they feel about the taxes to pay for those services, people will say, oh, the taxes are too high. So to the extent that the governor campaigns on holding down taxes, I think he's popular. To the extent that he has to cut services, I think that's going to be a problem for the governor. It's clearly going to be a problem for the city and village officials who have to provide those services.
Was a collective bargaining system that we've had in force in Wisconsin for truly decades, was it broken? And I guess another way to ask the question is, Dan and Mark, you represent statewide trade associations. Did your trade associations ever at any time ask for the extent of dialing back collective bargaining that the governor is recommending and on the verge of getting? Mark.
We've held a position for many years in support of the elimination of binding arbitration. I'm not sure that anyone in county government contemplated that we would not have collective bargaining as well. Now, to be fair, we still do have collective bargaining. It's on wages only,
wages
in the current package.
Capped by CPI.
Some would say that's not effectively really collective bargaining.
Right.
But we've supported elimination of binding arbitration. We thought that portion of the bargaining process did not work very well for the management side of the deliberations for some time. To the earlier point, however, the governor would say that no one should be surprised. I mean, I campaigned on this and I told people I was going to do this. Now, you can't possibly in a campaign lay out all of the details. So the counter to that is, well, we didn't know it was going to look exactly like this. But I think the governor has a point to make, that I said I was going to balance the budget. I said there was going to be a lot of pain. I said people were going to not receive service tomorrow that they are receiving today. I said all those things. And this budget is proving true in that regard. Now, none of us that received money previously and are not going to tomorrow are going to like it. And the citizens that received a service or a benefit yesterday and will not tomorrow aren't going to like it either. But to the governor's defense, he believes that is the course of action which will put our state on a course for future success. We can debate whether we agree with that or not, but he believes that, and he believes this budget will put us in that position.
Well, I want to give Dan a chance to answer, and then I want to come back to Larry, as somebody who runs one city. Did the league think collective bargaining system was as broken as the governor portrayed?
The way you asked the question was, did we ever oppose collective bargaining? The answer is yes. From 1975 until 92, the league's position was, we supported the, like Mark's organization indicated, the elimination of the mediation arbitration portion of collective bargaining. That's not the same thing as eliminating unions.
That's right.
We changed that position based on a conference resolution that was adopted, I believe, in 92, might have been in 93, that said we recognize the importance of collective bargaining, we as an organization, but we want these specific changes made in the collective bargaining law. So that has been our position consistently now for the last 18 years and is still our position. There is a list of 8 provisions that we adopted last October, that we 8 amendments to the collective bargaining laws that we wanted enacted.
As a person that runs a city, your response to the collective bargaining changes, good or not so good?
Well, again, that remains to be seen. I appreciate Mark's comment about the governor's good intent to deal with this difficult budget situation, but the changes are dramatic. They're institutional in nature, and it remains to be seen what the actual impact is going to be beyond the employees paying for their health care. And the league has had a policy, as Dan indicates, for a number of years that articulated several reforms that we felt needed to be made to the collective bargaining law, but none of those changes in any way would impinge upon worker rights to bargain collectively. None of them would in any way impinge upon the union security provisions that are built into these contracts and authorized under the collective bargaining law. And
I think the collection of union dues, for that matter.
Yeah, the collection of union dues, which is a union security issue. Right. The league's policy has talked about things like requiring arbitrators to focus more on economics when they make decisions rather than simply looking at comparables, not to take fund balances into consideration, which are one-time revenues, don't grant an ongoing salary increase, which is a repetitive expense based on a one-time revenue. Things like that that we think actually would probably make collective bargaining a little stronger and economically a little more realistic.
Well, I'm going to ask a fairness question. Is it fair to exempt local police and firefighters from these changes? Mr. City Manager?
Well, this is one of the things we have a problem with. Not that I, have anything against police and fire. I certainly appreciate the governor's concern about our first responders, but I'll tell you, when it's snowing, our public works drivers are the first responders, and they're out front, and all of our employees work together as a team. So, and there's good morale in the corporation, and again, we have weather events, we have public works and police and fire interacting together, often making calls together, because we need the public works trucks running up front to get the ambulance or the police car to the scene. And there's a lot of concern about the disparate treatment and how that's going to affect morale and esprit de corps within the corporations, and I can tell you, years ago when collective bargaining was first starting, often only the police and or the fire departments were organized, and we were negotiating with them, but then we would generalize if benefits were improved or if their salary increase were approved, we would generalize that across the workforce. And I think that's probably what you're going to see happen in most jurisdictions with this change. So there's still going to be collective bargaining in the counties and cities even after this is done.
Well, Mark, the fairness issue, fair to exempt the county sheriff's departments?
Well, I think the result is going to be employee morale issues.
Okay.
I'm convinced of that. I think it's going to be problematic for many years to come. It seems to me, in terms of a fairness question, if you're going to impose this sort of a policy on public servants, then I'm not so sure that you treat one sector of the public servants different than another. But I want to speak just to the larger issue just for a moment, Steve. I think what happened on this issue is that while all of us are going to live with the specifics and the aftermath of this, this issue really isn't Wisconsin's issue. We don't own this anymore. I think very shortly after it was introduced, it became the ownership of political interests far beyond the borders of this state. And so we have sides that have been set up that will not permit the parties within Wisconsin to come to any sort of a compromise. And yet, when all the dust settles and people leave this city and this state, we will be living with the aftermath of that, and there are going to be some tremendous challenges with
that.
Did
you have a follow-up on that, Larry, before we get to Dan?
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly add, I think one of the unintended consequences of this whole matter is this thing now has put Wisconsin at the center of the national culture war over unions, particularly over unions in the public sector. And as Mark says, it makes it difficult now for us to focus internally on our local issues within the state, because there are outside political interests on both sides of the issue that have now co-opted this battle, and we're on the national news, we're on the cable networks every day now because we're, we're the central focus, I guess, of the debate that's going on between the right and the left political factions in the country over labor unions.
As we speak, there are more than 20 camera crews in the state assembly chamber where, as you know, they're debating the budget repair bill.
Yes.
Is it fair to exempt police and firefighters, sir?
I don't know whether it's fair or not. I think it's a mistake to exempt police and firefighters. That's worse than being unfair. It's just a mistake. It's going to
for all these reasons that they
for
said
all these morale? Reasons that they've identified, and the notion that the folks in the utilities and the other folks are not providing vital services is one, wrong. Two, it's a terrible insult to those employees. Fire departments are a standby service, a very important service. When your house catches on fire, you want the fire department there, but it's a standby service. The police department is essentially a standby service. They're on duty all the time, but you call them when you need them. I would be willing to bet that everybody in the city turned on a tap once today. Almost everybody has used the toilets today. That stuff doesn't just happen. There are utility workers working day and night to keep those facilities working. It doesn't do us any good to scramble a fire truck to a fire scene if the fire hydrant doesn't work.
See, these specifics are what's being overlooked, and we're getting into broad characterizations of labor and of management. I personally do not believe that the proposals were meant to specifically do nothing more than hurt labor. I also don't believe that labor is out to get every possible penny without regard to the services and needs of the municipality. I've talked with the labor leaders. They're caring people. They want to do great job. They represent very good people. They want a successful city, town, village, school district, county. They want that. They desire that. They want a successful state. And I believe that management wants a successful state. But the characterizations suit not this news story, but some of the other news stories that of national nature. To characterize the extremes suits that purpose. It sets up a confrontation, much of which really isn't true.
Well,
if I could add, this is one of our very great concerns, is all of these public employees are absolutely critical to our completion of our mission. They all work together. They all interact together extremely well. And as part of this conversion of this issue to a broader culture war issue now, there's this vilification of the public service also that's going on that I think is a great concern. I can tell you I've had a similar experience to Mark in working with our unions. We've had a very, very professional, collegial relationship with those collective bargaining units going back for years. We've done a number of changes to our health care plan to try to make that more affordable and reasonable. The unions collaborated 2 years ago. We did a two-year pay freeze to try to get through the last two budgets, which were extremely difficult, and we made tons of cuts, and now here we are in a third round trying to make yet another round of cuts. So our working relationship with our union representatives has been excellent over the years. Certainly we disagree and we have spats over one issue or another, and they file grievances when they feel they need to. But overall, we've had a good collegial relationship and we hope that continues.
Let's talk about the numbers that were in the governor's budget summary that you gentlemen have before you. Mark, I'm going to start with you.
Yeah.
Basically, the governor said, with my tools of rewriting the collective bargaining process, mm-hmm. counties could save $64.3 million next year. Mm-hmm. I'm only cutting, this is the governor's number, $63.8 million. So your potential savings, if counties implemented all the collective bargaining changes, outweigh Governor Walker's cuts. Your reaction, sir?
I think we'd have to look under the hood of these numbers very carefully. I mean, we have contracts in counties throughout the state that go to 2012, 2013. We have even a few that go to 2014.
So those costs are locked up until 2012, 13, and in some cases, 14.
Unless we open up the contracts, which I think is highly unlikely.
Highly unlikely.
We're unable to actually realize any cuts, any savings there, if you're going to realize the savings through employee reductions. At the same time, in some of the other aid areas, we're still adding them up. We have an income maintenance administration, significant cut in that area. We have a juvenile corrections cut. There's a lot of areas, and we'd have to add those up to see if they match up. Now, the other question that it begs the question, if you're going to have this body of cuts, let's say $100 of cuts. Do you take care of all of those cuts through the employees? And there are some counties, I'm certain of this, they've told me this, there are some counties that would say, I have my $10 of cuts. I'm not so sure I want to take any of the cuts out of the employees. I might take it in other areas. Mm-hmm. What some counties have said is this. There's a reduction in revenue, in aid, for us to perform the state's job at the quality level the state desires. Tell us what that cut is, and then we'll manage it. But what we have is a directive that here's the cut, and here's how you will manage it. You will use this particular tool.
Yes.
Now, many counties will say, I'm fine with that tool. Others will say, I'd like the option. I'd like some flexibility.
Okay. Now, Dan, before I get to Larry, because I want Larry to talk about how it looks from what running one community. The governor's numbers, if you rewrote your collective bargaining agreements, perhaps reopen them, the municipalities could save $98 million, and our aid cuts are about that $98 million. How do you respond to that math, Dan?
Well, the devil is in the details, Steve, and as you well know, we don't have the details. If we had the details, you'd have somebody here talking about the details. Instead, you have us talking about generalities. That's all I can really do. I don't understand where the numbers come from. I'm sure the governor's staff did the best they could. When I look at the health insurance contribution number at 4.2%,
yes,
I have some trouble understanding where the $42 million number comes from. The governor is showing a $55 million savings from the WRS contribution. And that's almost 6% of salary for half the workforce. And he's showing a $42 million savings for health insurance. Well, a fair number of communities are already have employees paying 5, 10, or higher percentage of their health care premiums already. So going to 12% won't save that community very much money. The $55 million savings from WRS contributions looks high to me. The health insurance contribution at $42.6 million looks particularly high.
Okay.
So that's all we really know at this point.
You can't justify these numbers.
I didn't calculate these numbers, and I don't know the supporting data.
They're from the governor's budget summary.
Yes,
okay, Larry, here's
from.
What it means. The governor says if you exercise the new collective bargaining changes that I'm giving you, the tools, you will pretty much save more than I'm going to cut your shared revenue. And from the city of Beloit's perspective, sir?
Well, we don't know all the details yet. As everyone else has commented, these are numbers at a very macro level. They're aggregates out of the budget document. The health number is also troubling to me because the only changes that are mandated by statute are for participants in the state's health care program. Many of us, including Beloit, are not in that plan. And there's nothing in this statute that mandates any specific increase in employee contributions toward those premium costs for those health plans. All those have yet to be negotiated, particularly with the police and fire employees. And as Dan was saying, many cities already have their employees contributing. In fact, most cities are already contributing at an 8 or 10% level. So I'm not sure how that savings is going to actually manifest itself. We're still waiting for numbers from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, which we've been promised, that will show us exactly what the shared revenue cuts are projected to be for all of the cities, and I presume the counties. Mm-hmm. And at that point, we'll have a better idea of how this breaks down to the local level, what the impact on the budget's going to be, and whether or not the savings from employees paying health or paying the pension contribution will be enough to offset the cuts.
One other subject that's a big part of the governor's plan is to head off major increases in property taxes. Mm-hmm. He has clamped down on what local governments how much they can raise their property taxes by tying the increase in property taxes to new construction. Mm-hmm. What was new construction in a recession in Beloit? Did you have any last year?
Not only did we not have any, we lost value. Our values dropped some 8% across the board. Our residential values dropped about 10%, so we had a drop in assessed value. And looking forward, there's been some very minor new construction this year, but it will not produce any additional property tax revenue. So we're looking at a zero increase in revenues from the property tax, which is the only source of taxation we have at the local level. So the governor has clearly set this budget up again, to force all the local governments around the state to make all of these reductions on the expenditure side of their budgets.
And for the
let me interrupt.
Go, Dan. You've been doing this a few years. Go.
I've been doing this 36 years, and you didn't say it quite right.
All right. Correct me, my friend.
I will correct you. The governor did not say to the communities that they cannot raise property taxes. What the governor said is to the city councils and to the village boards, you cannot raise property taxes. The citizens still have the right to do so.
Referendums?
Through a referendum. Now, when I say that, people go, poo-poo, voters will never vote for higher taxes.
And what if I said, poo-poo, voters will never...
I would say to you that the state of Colorado lived under Tabor for 13 years.
Tabor.
And there were seven, and that, which is essentially these sorts of tight restrictions. You're familiar.
I went to Colorado. I looked at Tabor.
There were 700 local referendums in Colorado in those 13 years, municipal referendums, almost 80% of them passed.
You're an optimistic guy.
Well, when you ask people, here's your choice, citizens. We're either going to close the library or the park or police officers, whatever. Do you want us to do that? We're the city council. Do you want us to eliminate these services? Or do you want to pay an extra $10, $20, $30 a year on your property taxes? In a great many communities in this state, I will predict here and now that that referendum will pass.
And will one of them be the city of Beloit, Mr. Manager?
I seriously doubt it.
I
don't think the economy and the demographics of our population would be conducive to that. But I certainly wouldn't rule anything out at this point. One of the commitments we've already made to the city is that we're planning on doing some town hall type meetings, workshops with council. We're going to be meeting with all of our employees and collective bargaining units. So we're going to reach out to all the stakeholders and have discussions about how we deal with this budget even before we start the formal budget preparation process this summer. And that certainly could be a point of discussion. Certainly we will be talking about more user fees for recreation type programs and other things that are of an optional nature. The recycling grants that have been cut are going to necessitate increasing fees for solid waste collection. So all of those topics are going to be discussed.
Mark, go ahead. I was coming to you next.
This is troubling, and here's why. If we want a successful state with more people making more money, engaged in more commerce, more employment, if we want a vibrant economy, one of in a new millennium knowledge technology-based economy, the number one resource for profit for private sector business is not oil, paper pulp, water, it's smart people, smart young people to be specific. And we need to have a lot of them. So when we look at where the smart young people are and what attracts them, when you look at the list of things that they desire, 80% are things that government funds. So what that tells us is this. If you want this supply, the number one resource for private sector profit, smart young people, invest in your communities and make them attractive to these smart young people. So they want to move here. They want to stay. It's not just, the four of us are baby boomers. We actually thought that you could buy happiness. Give us enough money somewhere and we could be happy. The smart young wealth makers of tomorrow think differently. In my opinion, they're actually smarter than us, but they think differently. So with this provision, we will be unable to invest in our communities and make them more attractive to the thing we desire most.
Okay, we're running short on time, but if you can't offset the cuts in state aid through savings by reworking your collective bargaining, I have this question. What services are residents of your munis going to see being cut a year from now? Let's assume the governor's budget passes. There's enough GOP legislators in both houses to pretty much pass it. If it passes, what services are going to be cut? What do you want to tell your residents of your municipalities, hey, you're going to do without, finish that please.
I represent 582 cities and villages across the state, Steve. That answer will be different in every community. And there will be wealthy communities where they can afford to pay more, and they will do so. Will be other communities that will not be able to afford to pay, and they won't do so. That's where the referendums will fail.
Most of your 500 communities, will they have no choice but to provide less services, Dan?
Oh, I think that's correct.
A matter of different
picking
services.
And choosing. Yes.
Okay.
Well, I think we're seeing a downsizing. I think we are likely to see a downsizing of municipal services across the state. The question becomes, at what point is that downsizing so painful that the voters through referendum will say no more, no more downsizing.
Okay.
We want to preserve some core services here. And what is a core service will change from community to community.
Larry, what do the city, what do the residents of the city of Beloit need to know? What services might they lose or be cut, see cutbacks in a year as a result of the governor's budget?
Well, I think, first of all, we want to share with them all of the services and programs we provide and seek input. As I indicated earlier, we're going to be holding a series of town hall meetings and workshops. We're going to be reaching out to our employees. We're going to be talking to all the stakeholders to find out what's most important to them. The last two budget cycles have been extremely difficult for municipalities. We've already done all of the traditional things you do to make cuts. We've eliminated positions. We've done early retirement programs. We haven't made a payment into an equipment depreciation or computer replacement fund in over 2 years. We've cut operating and commodity budgets in our police and fire departments. We have, you know, made significant cutbacks already. It is going to be very difficult to absorb another round of cuts without going after the services. And I will also tell you...
Services like?
Services from everything from parks and recreation services and facilities to police and fire services, snow removal, public works services, all of those things are going to be on the table for discussion. And I will tell you that one of the things I think we do well in Beloit, and I think a lot of cities do well, is we evaluate our services every year. And things that don't get public support are not continued. Things that we do, facilities we run, get a lot of public support. There's a lot of participations. And people are not going to be happy to give up any of those services. And I know they gripe and complain about taxes, but when you come in and say, okay, now you don't want to pay taxes, it's time to close this facility, it's time to cut back on this service, cut back on snow removal service, the public is not going to want to do that.
And Mark?
It's easy. Discretionary services. Okay. What are they in counties? There are very few. Some juvenile delinquency programs, land and water conservation that are somewhat discretionary, some road discretionary activities, parks, recreation, the things that we have some control over, which is 10% of our budget, perhaps.
Okay. And then my final question, let's answer it quickly because we're about out of time. Is there a better way to improve the financial relationship between state and local governments? I'm going to go to Mark, but I'm going to ask him not for his one-hour seminar because I've heard it, as smart as it is. Is there a better way, Mark?
Yes, I think there is. I think there needs to be much more cooperation and much more visionary thinking 20, 30, 50 years into the future about what kind of a state we want and how we're going to get there together. The local units of government, we're representing the same people as our state legislators and as our governor. But we sometimes we get bogged down in the intramural politics as opposed to the great vision for our citizens. And I think very open conversations between local government and our state leaders would be incredibly helpful.
We ought to think beyond the next election cycle.
Well, and I think we're looking beyond that in this budget, that's for certain, yes.
Larry, is there a better way?
I think there's a better way. First of all, most states have some kind of a revenue sharing program that puts money into a local government distributive fund. It's not part of the biannual in Wisconsin or annual political cycle that goes with the budget preparation process. The Farmer Alliance of Cities, now the Urban Alliance of the League, has a proposal for how we could grow the sales tax base on a regional basis, mm-hmm. on a county-by-county basis, and share some of that money back with local governments. Another point I've got to make here, and I know we're running short on time, but we're setting on the same amount of shared revenue we were receiving in 1996. We're 14 years, okay? We're at the same revenue point we were 14 years ago. So general purpose units of government are not responsible for the state's budget deficits. We've had two major cuts in the last 10 years in shared revenue. This will be the third. And something is going to need to be done to provide adequate revenue flow for local governments to provide those critical services. And as the other speakers have said, the stuff we do is important. It is very important, from the utilities to the police to the fire. I can't tell you how many lives we save each year with our ambulance service, the recreation services and facilities that we operate. We have thousands and thousands of participations in those facilities every year. A lot of what leads to the quality of life in these communities opportunities that Mark was talking about are specific services, programs, and facilities that are provided by
the
local
government. Dan, after 37 years of work on this issue, if you were king, would you reinvent it?
Only 36 years.
Oh, sorry. Excuse me. After 36 years?
Larry touched on it, but he's absolutely right. The current relationship sends money back to over 1,800 individual units of government, plus 400 and some school districts and 72 counties. It's a very complicated system. Sending those dollars back on a regional basis to encourage regional cooperation, regional tax-based growth, regional investments would make a lot of sense. Individual communities in this state cannot compete internationally with Tokyo and Berlin and so on. We need to work together regionally to build those regional economies. We're not doing that, and the state local revenue system does not encourage that. In fact, it encourages competition between municipalities, which I think is not good for the state.
Gentlemen, thanks very much. It's a fascinating, because it deals with the quality of life in your communities, it's a fascinating subject. I want to thank you. Helping Wisconsin Eye viewers benefit from your experience. Dan Thompson, Larry Arf, Mark O'Connell, thank you
Steve.
Very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. It was a pleasure.